From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we meet the only actress who played identical cousins, Patty Duke. She also won an Academy Award for her portrayal of Helen Keller, and now she's the president of the Screen Actors Guild, but she's had many difficult times along the way. Also today, I speak with singer Helen Merrill. Merrill thinks her voice has gotten darker in the last 30 years, and you can hear it on her new album, a collaboration with arranger Gil Evans, of songs they first recorded together 30 years ago. And we have reviews of two new rap records and of the new George Lucas fantasy film, Willow. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Patty Duke was a child star. At the age of 12, she won over Broadway audiences as Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker. 3 years later, she played Helen Keller in the screen adaptation and became the youngest actor ever to win an Academy Award. She then got her own TV sitcom, The Patty Duke Show, and she became one of TV's most celebrated teens. Maybe because Patty Duke grew up in public view, many of us assumed we knew something about what her adolescence was like. But last year, she wrote an autobiography that was filled with surprises. For instance, when she was a child, her parents virtually turned her over to managers who took control not only of her career, but of her life. When they changed her name from Anna to Patty, they told her, "Anna Marie is dead. You're Patty now." Patty Duke's autobiography, Call Me Anna, has just been published in paperback. She's now serving her second term as the president of the Screen Actors Guild. Since the 1970s, she starred in many made-for-TV movies, including a remake of The Miracle Worker, in which she played Helen Keller's teacher, Ann Sullivan. Patty Duke, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, should I call you Patty Duke? I feel silly.
You can call me anything you want.
Okay. You know, in your book, you write about all this stuff that I certainly never knew about. I'm sure most of your fans never suspected. Mm-hmm. You know, bouts with manic depression, attempted suicide, stuff like that. Now that you've gone public with it, do you feel like more vulnerable, more exposed, or more like yourself because people know the real story of who you are?
Frankly, the net result that I didn't expect from the book is this sense of freedom or being freed, because there's nothing left.
Nothing
to certainly
hide.
No skeletons.
Uh-huh.
And the most extraordinary thing has been the exchange with other people who share the same illness as me, manic depression, and others who just want to reach out and say, "We didn't know. That was terrible. And boy, are we glad you didn't kill yourself, because it is a good life." And that has been a remarkable series of experiences for me over the last year.
I want to talk with you a little bit about some of the, you know, key things that have happened in your life. Your parents basically turned you over to these theater managers.
I prefer to put it another way,
yeah.
and this is in no way meant to be judgmental about the way you phrase the question, but
yeah.
To give a clearer picture,
mm-hmm.
I prefer to talk about the fact that my mother was really coerced to give me up.
Mm-hmm.
My mother also suffered from a mental illness until quite recently, a clinical and chronic depression. She was very insecure, had no money, limited education, and here were these people who seemed to be saying, "We have the yellow brick road in our pocket. And if you really love this little girl, if you really love her, then you'll be unselfish and you'll give her to us, and we will give her all the things you cannot." Well, I can almost imagine myself falling for that. It appeals to guilt, motherly guilt, that we're never good enough for our children. It certainly appeals to someone who feels inadequate about how to deal with life. And so that's what she responded to. My dad, by this time, was out of the picture. They had separated, and my father was an alcoholic and spent most of the rest of his very short life alienated from the family. So I went to live with them, and it seemed okay to my mom at the time, though very painful.
Did you protest?
No. It's interesting to me that I did not, because I was almost literally attached to my mother at the hip. I was a very dependent child, crazy about my mother. And these discussions happened without my being around, so that when the information was delivered to me, my mother had already steeled herself mm-hmm. for this, looked angry to me. I mean, that was my child's perception. Oh, she's mad at me. I did something wrong. And we didn't have the kind of household where you ask, where you questioned your mother about what was going on. So I assumed, stupidly, that this was what she wanted. And I went because I was going to be a good little girl. It's funny, even today I can get a little thing in my throat about it because it was the most painful separation of my life. Though I have her back in my life now, we have a full, rich mother-daughter relationship. That's something you can't ever make up for. And I admire my mother for the courage she's had to face that kind of pain.
What are some of the things that this couple did who took over your career to refashion you into the person they think they thought you should be?
Yeah, these folks, though they come out in a very negative light, for the most part in my book, were not complete villains in my eyes. And even in retrospect, I see that they had a talent. What they did was, number one, start schooling me in manners, taught me to speak in an English accent, so that their theory being that it would counteract the New York ease. I was a very New York kid who talked like this. Blah, 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 blah. Well, you can play one or two parts like that, but not very many. So there were many disciplined, highly disciplined hours of that kind of exercise, plus working on how I looked. Ethel, the wife of the twosome, often would tell me that I was very plain. Part of that, I think, was her attempt, though ill-guided, to keep me humble, to maintain control. And though I got much more affirmation from John Ross, the male part of the couple, her approval somehow carried a lot more weight for me.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Patty Duke, who's written an autobiography about her life and her career. Well, they helped you get an incredible part, the Broadway.
Absolutely. They did a lot of wonderful things. I started working quite early and well and with wonderful people in live television. And then, yes, the Miracle Worker was a year and a half of preparation before I was ever granted an audition.
What kind of preparation?
The preparation began, of course, with learning about Helen Keller, but only up until Annie Sullivan arrives in her life. Again, the theory being, don't give me more information than I need and maintain control. Then, on a daily basis, I was put through exercises pretending to be blind, stumbled around the house with my eyes closed, other exercises about being deaf. Games were played. You know, I was a kid, so they used the game approach, and I was not to hear anything, let's say, for an hour and a half. If sometime during that hour and a half the phone rang or Ethel said to me, there's a call for you, and I responded, I had blown the game. The difference in this kind of training is that not always were the methods kind. Mm-hmm. They weren't always evil, but there were often very denigrating remarks made rather than corrections. And again, it's something that I recall because it was important to me when I was raising kids to not do that to them, you know, to correct rather than call them wicked little whatever they are.
I remember the first time I saw The Miracle Worker, the movie, when I was a child. I liked the movie a lot, and it scared me a lot.
Really?
Yeah, it scared me because the whole idea that somebody could go through life both blind and deaf terrified me. And when you're a kid, you always figure, like, well, God, this could happen to me tomorrow, you know?
Sure.
So it was a very frightening thing, and I figured, gosh, it must have been frightening for you to, especially when you were playing it on Broadway when you were younger. Do you have to think about that so much, about what it would be like to be blind and deaf?
Frankly, I can't believe this, but I've never really thought of it in those terms before. I had many, many, many fears as a, and obsessive fears as a young person. And maybe I was incorporating them into that role. And I do know for a fact that the role was very therapeutic for me in many ways. The home life with the Rosses became quite distorted as I got to be 12 and 13 and 14, which were the miracle worker years. And to be able to go to a place every day and fight the authority figure full out, hit, bite, kick, and be applauded for it on top of that was incredible therapy. And what we now know is acting out therapy. Of course, I didn't know it then, but I do know that probably my illness would have shown itself much sooner if I didn't have those outlets. And, of course, the nurturing that I got from Anne Bancroft, not only on stage but off. She really, I think, is responsible for helping me through puberty. For, you know, if I never met Anne Bancroft, I probably still wouldn't know about birds and bees and all that kind of stuff. She was incredibly generous to me.
I just rented the movie recently to watch it again and was really, surprised at how good-looking the movie is, too, you know?
I was amazed.
Really nicely shot and lit it is.
It's wonderfully directed, and though I, you know, had a major crush on Arthur Penn, I wasn't too much of a film critic in those years. But as I looked at it recently myself, and it is a well-made film about, for me, the ultimate topic, which is the success of the human spirit. And when you couple that with wonderful art, wonderful photography, and well-directed actors, phew, it's a terrific film.
I think everyone who's seen the film remembers the scene of the breakthrough where Anne Bancroft as Helen Keller's teacher, Annie Sullivan, is working with you as Helen Keller in trying to teach the association between objects and words. And there's the scene at the water pump where she's pumping water and she's spelling it out to
and
you.
She's and angry, if you recall.
And she's angry,
she's
right.
She's angry at me because I've just done something very naughty in front of the rest of the family.
But as the water's pouring on your hand, things pause for a second and you suddenly, it's your only lines in the movie, really.
That's right.
You start to sound out water. I'd like to play that excerpt of the film.
Oh, how interesting. I've never done this before.
Let's hear it.
W-A-T-E-R, water. It has a name. W-A-T.
Scene from The Miracle Worker in which Patty Duke as Helen Keller speaks for the first time. What kind of advice were you given about how to make those sounds, the first controlled sounds you utter?
I don't think I've ever told this out loud in public before. I think I wrote about it in the book. Arthur Penn wanted a particular sound, obviously, the one we just heard. And I was a little girl with a little voice, and it just kept coming out, and that wasn't it. And he gave me what I think is an absolutely brilliant direction and an impossible one for a little teenage girl who has a crush on the director to take. He came to me and he said, "Have you ever been constipated? I thought I would die." I mean, here he is. God is talking to me about constipation. I said, "Huh?" He said, "Well, you think about that. And then when it comes to that time, besides all the other things that you're feeling and doing, I want you to incorporate that." And, of course, that's what you hear. And it is a wonderful symbol for Helen's intellectual constipation for those 6 years. There's a line that comes a little bit after this that belongs to Anne Sullivan. It's when the parents come out of the house and they're wondering what's going on and what is all this yelling about. And she says she knows. I tell you, to this day, when I watch that movie or hear that, or even hear those words, it has such impact on me. That tells me that knowledge and communication and understanding are probably the keys to what I'm all about.
Actress Patty Duke is my guest. You know, it's really amazing. You went from the miracle worker, doing it for years on stage and then on screen, to starring in this sitcom about this about two well-adjusted teenagers.
Not a logical progression, huh?
Really.
Again, believe it or not, the cleverness of the Rosses, and I mean this in a positive way.
The people who managed.
Yes, the mentors. They predicted that, remember, back then we didn't have quite as many shows for teens as we do now, and they predicted that there was going to be a transition problem. Many young actors didn't make it through the teens and into adult acting. So the plan was, as long as we've got this offer for this television series, we'll put her in that. That'll get her through those, quote, awkward years. Now, it made sense to them, but I must tell you, I was not there for the telephone call, but I'm aware that Arthur Penn, when he heard that this was the deal that had been made, called up and just wanted to whip them soundly for this hideous mistake. In some ways, I think even today that Arthur was right.
Uh-huh.
I will never be sorry about the Patty Duke show, because that has given me an access to the public that I don't know I could have gotten any other way. And an access on many levels. But I think that one of the many speculations about why I don't have a film career, you know, on the big screen, is that I moved into television quite early, and folks simply hold up this one piece of remarkable work and say, oh, when she was a child, she did this. And now I'm thought of as a whole other entity. I no longer feel bitter about that, because I've found ways to use it in a positive way for myself. But it is one of the explanations for why, when I say to myself, why is that one playing that role? Now, I could have played that. It's one of the many reasons.
My guest is actress Patty Duke, who's written an autobiography, which is titled Call Me Anna. We're going to talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Patty Duke is my guest, and she's currently serving in her second term as president of the Screen Actors Guild.
I have to tell you.
Well, you're not?
You know what that sounds like to me? Oh, yes, I am. Oh. Yes, I am, unfortunately. It's beginning to sound to me like it's a prison sentence.
Oh.
I'm serving my second
She's serving
term.
Her sentence.
Exactly.
Do you mind if I ask you just a couple of things about the Patty Duke show?
You can ask me anything you want.
Who came up with this idea of identical cousins? If for our listeners who don't remember the show, Patty Duke played this like really popular American teenager, and also played this American teenager's Scottish cousin who was much more prim, proper, and conservative.
My goodness,
didn't know about rock and roll.
didn't seem to know much about anything that had to do with the quote real world.
Now they were identical cousins. They
identical
looked exactly
cousins.
The same.
Do you not
Patty
love
Duke
that?
Played both of them.
I have no idea why Sidney Sheldon is the man who created the show.
Mr. Bloodline?
Yes. Why cousins? I don't know. I think it had something to do with, you know, why wouldn't they have been in the household the same, you know, all these years behaving the same way. Also, I think they wanted some version of God knows what that accent was that I did. but I must say, most people, when they talk to me about it, you know, folks on the street talk about the twins. They forgot the cousin part.
Well, I think I went through my early years thinking, can there be identical cousins?
Oh, my God.
Is this possible?
I love it. We were filled with misinformation on that show, but I must say, I just saw, again, I was never allowed to watch that show. So I saw it only recently, and I was kind of happily surprised. All these years, I'd been kind of embarrassed by the whole thought, and I really would kind of, you know, turn my head and eyes away when people would mention it. for its genre. It was quite a lovely little show, and they were nice people, and they weren't saying nasty, hideous things to each other all the time. And I kind of miss that element of a family show.
We know you mentioned that you weren't allowed to watch it. It's because the people who were managing you thought it would go to your head if you got
exactly,
to see yourself.
Exactly, yes. We dealt a lot in keeping me humble.
So what
it
really
worked.
When you watched it for the first time as an adult, this was recently that you saw it for the
it
first
was
time?
2 years ago. My husband was still in the Army. I was visiting from Los Angeles, and he was in Georgia. And I was waiting at the hotel for him to get off duty. And so I turned on the television thinking I'd watch some talk show in the middle of the afternoon. And I heard the theme. Now, the theme I had heard before because people sing it to me verbatim on the street corners often. So there it was. And it was a strange sensation. I mean, there I was all alone in this hotel room, and I was going to turn it off. And now I don't know if that was a knee-jerk reaction from the Rosses or I was afraid I was going to be mortified or what. And I thought, nope, this is it. I'm going to watch it. And I went and I put the Do Not Disturb on the door so the maid wouldn't catch me watching the Patty Duke show. And I sat there on the edge of the bed. And yes, I was at first embarrassed, particularly about how I looked. How could anybody let me go out of the house looking like that, with that flipped up hair and the turned under hair? And they were three-quarter wigs with this crevice.
Yeah, the headband on all the time.
Oh, yes, that was to hide the crease. And the more I watched, the more I thought, oh, she really wasn't that ugly, that girl. And this is kind of a nice show. And then I noticed that I was also doing some very nice acting work.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, based on very thin premise, but nonetheless, there was some very real work going on there. So I was glad I finally saw it, and I don't have to go cringing and skulking through hallways anymore when I hear the music.
You know, throughout our conversation, we've been referring to the two people who managed you and
mm-hmm.
did
John and Ethel
yeah,
Ross.
Yeah, were pretty tyrannical about it. How'd you get away from them?
Oh, the typical way, I guess, a young girl in those days got away from the family they didn't like. I got married.
Right.
I was ill-equipped to do that or anything else at that point, because once I made the move, the manic depressive symptoms came out. Once there were not the Ross's disciplines on the behavior, the demons, if you will, woke up, and I was quite out of control in the late 60s.
I think it wasn't until 1982 that you were actually diagnosed.
That's correct.
As manic depressive, and you started taking both chemical and
counseling. Talk therapy,
Talk therapy, yeah. What were some of the things that you thought were happening to you before you had the manic depressive diagnosis?
It was very difficult to even think about it, you know, to have conscious thoughts about it. When I would be in a manic phase, certainly I thought everything was fine. Now, it was rather bizarre behavior I was exhibiting, but it seemed okay to me because I was comfortable out there. Your mind races. Thoughts come so quickly that you can't get them out of your mouth fast enough. Manics talk very quickly. Spending huge sums of money that I didn't even have.
Mm-hmm.
I went into credit card hell. When I would come down from that, and there were many other symptoms of it as well, just a lot of acting out stuff and self-destructive stuff. But I felt a sense of euphoria. When I would come down from that and sort of head into the depressive time, there were pretty level times, really. And you didn't think about what you just did because that's just too much to deal with. You have to block that completely. And I also never learned to know that what was coming was the black hole. And I would go into that for 3 and 4 months at a time, be for a good deal of that time non-functional. I mean, literally staying in bed, crying or past the crying, or suicidal.
So this did not help other relationships or
it's,
work.
It's not what you should no. bring to a marriage.
No, exactly. So now all that's under control.
Yeah, it's very important for me to people understand how it gets under control, so that we don't, you know, think, oh, there's this wonderful miracle. You know, It is a very difficult diagnosis to make, can be made, though. People who are feeling similar symptoms need to go to a doctor, usually a psychiatrist. That's, of course, always the giant step. It's a giant step well worth taking. I then, after my diagnosis was made, I was put on lithium. And I fortunately have no bad side effects from lithium. Some people do. Most people tolerate it quite well. That, within 3 weeks, leveled me. I was now in a therapeutic range and in control of the mood swings. That doesn't mean I don't, you know, get happy or get sad. It just means that I can deal with them when I do. And, of course, I have to stress that continuing a healthy relationship with your psychiatrist is only wise. It's very wise to do. You know, many people stop taking their medicine because they miss the high. And I can only say, yeah. Don't do that. Don't do that. I would no more stop taking my medicine than fly to the moon. It's a fascinating illness, but it's fascinating when it's history.
Patty Duke is my guest. You are now in your second term as president of the Screen Actors
yes.
Guild. Why did you want to do that, to go into organizing and to be in an administrative and a leadership position, which is very different?
I wish I could tell you that I had thought it out that completely. I had become very active in my union, and about time, I might say. Most of us sort of, you know, get our card and that's it. We don't pay attention. When it became apparent that union busting was becoming a way of life in mm-hmm. our country, I became, just as a citizen, more and more concerned. Yes, I wanted more of a leadership role. When some people suggested that I should run for the presidency of the Guild, it was at first a very heady kind of idea. But I also needed to know that I could back it up, that I could do the work. Once I decided that I could do that, I also wanted the label of respectability. When you've been manic depressive and you have done very strange things, it's very important to you to show mm-hmm. to people that you are responsible and respectable. And once you do that, then you can relax and be responsible and respectable. You don't have to keep showing everybody.
So you think you're in that stage now where you
yeah.
can just relax about it?
Well, I never relax about that job. You know, it's not exactly the kind of job people call up and say, oh, things are swell.
I wish we had more time to talk, but we're out of time. It's
You're
really been
delight.
A pleasure to have you
and
here.
And this is a wonderful program, and I'm so glad it's so successful and it'll stay on.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. My guest has been actress Patty Duke, and she's now the president of the Screen Actors Guild. Her autobiography has just been published in paperback. It's titled Call Me Anna, and it's published by Bantam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tomorrow, our guest will be New Orleans songwriter and producer Alan Toussaint. His hits included Mother-in-Law, Yes We Can, and Whipped Cream. Tomorrow, he'll perform some of his songs in a live concert in our studio. In the meantime, here's Lee Dorsey singing one of Alan Toussaint's songs, Working in a Coal Mine.
Working in a coal mine, going down. About to step down, working in a coal mine, going down, 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 working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
5 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord, I'm so tired. How long can this go on?
Yeah, they're working in a coal mine, going down, 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 working in a coal mine, whoop. About to step down,
working
in a coal mine,
going
down, down, down,
working
in a coal mine, oops, about to step down.
Cause I make a little money, hauling coal by the dawn, but when Saturday rolls around, I'm too tired.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Years ago, singer Helen Merrill recorded an album of songs with arrangements by Gil Evans. Shortly before Evans' death, Merrill and Evans collaborated on a new recording of those same songs. Coming up, we listen with Helen Merrill to the old and new records. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new rap records, one by one of today's most popular groups, Run DMC, and the other by a new group, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. And guest movie critic Michael Schrago reviews the new fantasy adventure film, Willow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Administration officials are back to square one in their effort to get Panama's General Manuel Noriega to relinquish power. Since their negotiations with the general collapsed yesterday afternoon, administration officials have begun a wide-ranging series of consultations. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
As if to answer charges that they'd put together their Panama policy without adequate consultation, administration officials today made a point of seeking the advice of Congress and Latin American leaders. Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams huddled with the Senate Western Hemisphere Subcommittee this morning. And all across Latin America, U.S. ambassadors have been instructed to meet with the presidents or foreign ministers of their host countries. Secretary Abrams denied that the failed negotiations had hurt the United States.
It was well worth trying, and if we had it to do over again, we would try it again. At the very least, it demonstrated to people who were in doubt that we were willing to try and that he was not willing to make this effort.
An interagency task force within the Reagan administration met today to consider other ways of getting Noriega to leave. Military force has not been ruled out, but it seems unlikely for now. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In Nicaragua, peace talks between the Nicaraguan government and the Contras took a turn for the worse today. The government has angrily rejected a Contra proposal for a final settlement of the civil war. More from David Golub.
What has made the Sandinistas so angry is that the proposal throws most of the terms of the original agreement, signed 2 months ago, out the window. Within 5 days and without any corresponding concessions by the rebels, the government would have to release all political prisoners, abolish military service, and open up a private television station for use by opposition groups. The government did originally agree to release prisoners, but only as the Contras took steps toward disarmament. There was no commitment to end the draft or to open a private TV station. A Contra spokesman denied that the rebels were backing away from the original agreement, but the new Contra demands go much further. With only 4 days to go before a temporary truce expires, it seems more unlikely now than ever that the peace process can be saved. For National Public Radio, I'm David Golub in Managua.
A hitch was reported today in President Reagan's schedule for his fourth summit with Mikhail Gorbachev. The Soviet Union has canceled one of the president's meeting with Gorbachev, and they're questioning the makeup of a religious group scheduled to talk with Mr. Reagan in Moscow. The White House said the decision to call off one of the sessions with Gorbachev was mutual. The president is in Finland today, preparing for his talks next week. More from NPR's Bill Buesenberg.
Except for a speech and a meeting with the president of Finland tomorrow, President Reagan is remaining in seclusion in Helsinki, staying at a government guesthouse a few miles from the center of the city. He'll travel to Moscow on Sunday. Despite the official inactivity, various human rights groups are using the Helsinki stopover to make their case that the Soviet Union violates the rights of its citizens by not allowing them to immigrate. One man is here on behalf of his fiancée, who for 17 months has been denied permission to leave the Soviet Union so they can get married. There are at least half a dozen American Jewish organizations here advocating increased immigration for Soviet Jews. They report that Soviet authorities have been harassing so-called refuseniks and preventing them from traveling to Moscow to meet on Monday with President Reagan. White House officials say the Soviets have promised to allow all of those invited to attend such a meeting. But 28 people in Leningrad were told today that they had no right to be in Moscow at the time of the summit. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Helsinki.
The House of Representatives today approved a compromise $1.1 trillion budget resolution containing $135.3 billion deficit for the 1989 fiscal year. The resolution, passed by a vote of 201 to 181, follows the guidelines set in last year's budget negotiations between the White House and Congress. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 5 points today on Wall Street, closing at 1966.75. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rap music has gone from the outskirts of pop into the mainstream. Rock music critic Ken Tucker has a review of two new albums, one from one of rap's most established groups, Run DMC, and the other from a new Philadelphia group, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
Get down! It's rather extraordinary, so your bus is commentary. A literary genius and a superior beat creator have come together, and we made a musical composition, which we think is a remedy to cure all the dance floors that's empty. You wanna dance? We got what you want. Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince buzzing out with a brand new funk.
The most interesting pop music tour of the summer may well prove to be the one Run DMC will launch in about a month. Run DMC is the most vital of all of the first wave of rap groups that emerged in the late 1970s, and their opening act will be the brightest young rappers on the scene, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, who take the innovations of Run DMC for granted and proceed to make their own quirkily original music. Run DMC's new album, Tougher Than Leather, essentially recapitulates the work they did on their 1986 album, Raising Hell. Like that record, this one combines couplets written in a strict ABAB rhyme scheme with rock and roll instrumentation not often heard on rap records, squalling electric guitar and rock drumming. The last time out, this enabled Run DMC to reach listeners who would normally shun rap. The group volunteered to make its music accessible to the rock audience. This new album proceeds from the idea that people now know that rap is not a cult item, but a legitimate pop form. Run DMC makes no concessions to mass taste when they do something like the cut I'm about to play. It's a rap reinterpretation of Mary Mary, a 60s song originally recorded by the Monkees.
Mary Mary, why you bugging? Mary Mary, I need you hugging.
Like the best rap acts, there's a level on which Run DMC treats its work less as music than as an artistic gesture. Rap the way they and many of their generation do it is a musical form of collage. A composition is created by juxtaposing bits of pre-existing music and placing it in new, often revelatory contexts. A prime example of this on the Run DMC album is Papa Crazy. It uses snippets of the old Temptations hit Papa Was a Rolling Stone to create an utterly different song. In contrast to Run DMC, who convert all sorts of pop music into trademark hard-edged rap, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince confront the primary criticism leveled at rap. You know, the old rock and roll one, it all sounds the same. Their album, He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper, displays a wide variety of musical styles, tempos, and rap vocal attitudes. Take this, for example, a song called Time to Chill, which attempts the rap version of a ballad and whose lyric is a discussion of that fact.
For years I have been waiting and hesitating to make a rap record that had the pace of a slow song, quiet storm, chilling while the fire is warm. You and your girl with this record on your radio or stereo. I don't know, I love you so is what you'll be saying while this record's playing. You're reminiscing and kissing your girl. Relax, lay back, unwind, because now it's time to chill.
I think what I like most about Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince is that they're acutely self-conscious about what they do. They're smart guys, very much aware of where their music fits into the pop scene. And yet they never let that self-consciousness paralyze them. They remain breezy, clever fellows. Here's a good example of that, a song about an eternal adolescent problem called Parents Just Don't Understand.
I remember one year my mom took me school shopping. It was me, my brother, my mom, my pop, and my little sister all hopped in the car. We headed downtown to the gallery.
started bugging with the clothes she chose. I didn't say nothing at first, I just turned to my nose. She said, what's wrong? This shirt cost $20. I said, Mom, the shirt is plaid with a butterfly collar. The next half hour was the same old thing. My mother buying me clothes from 1963, and then she lost her mind and did the ultimate. I asked her for Adidas and she bought me Zips. I said, Mom, what are you doing? You ruined my rep.
She said, you're only 16, you don't have a rep yet. I said, Mom, let's put these clothes back, please. She said, no, you go to school to learn, not for a fashion show. I said, this isn't shining, not come on, Mom.
Rap music can reach its full, most potent force in live performance. Forget the misinformed malarkey you may have heard about rap concerts inciting violence. I've been going to Run DMC shows since they started performing, and they're no rowdier than any number of rock acts whose mayhem quotient is also grossly overrated. The point is, if you're at all curious about rap, this is the music to check out.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
The objective of this musical extravaganza is to enlighten you stanza by stanza. Verse after verse has been precisely arranged, rearranged, and then changed until the best remains. So for at least 8 hours a day, you'll have this record on in the morning and at night in your room, and all through the afternoon, you will be listening mentally wrapped up in the cut. Some people will sit down and some will choose to get up, but whatever you choose, just keep your ear to the wax, because we got something depth that other rappers lack. We haven't been able to put our fingers on what it is, but it's different and it's definite, appeals to kids and teens and adults and senior citizens too, and I'd be willing to bet you that it appeals to you too. So if you're not into rap, give us a chance to change your mind and to make you dance to this lyrical miracle, this musical discovery. But yo, I wanna chill for a second. Yo, Jeff,
this is Fresh Air. More than 30 years ago, before jazz arranger Gil Evans became known for his collaborations with Miles Davis on now classic albums like Miles Ahead, Porgy and Bess, and Sketches of Spain, he did arrangements for an album by singer Helen Merrill. Shortly before Evans' death in March, he and Helen Merrill went back to the studio to re-record the material from their earlier record. Although Merrill has recorded more than 35 albums in her career, she's better known in Europe and Japan, where she lived for many years. Now she lives in New York City. I asked Helen Merrill how she and Gil Evans made the decision to re-record the old material.
He wanted to make a new record with me, and he was very enthusiastic and so on. But unfortunately, Gil's health was declining somewhat. He was having a problem with his eyes, and it was difficult for him to write. So we then thought of doing the old music over again, which is never really old. It's a form of classical music as far as I'm concerned.
I'd like to try something. Can we compare a song from the two records and see how they sound in the older version and the new version?
Sure.
Great. Why don't we start with the new record? And this is your new recording with arrangements by Gil Evans of I'm a Fool to Want You.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool.
Listening back to that, what do you think you did differently than in the first version?
Well, in the first place, it's a half tone lower.
<That's>, okay.
And in the second, I do a song differently every time I sing it. It's a different feeling. I've been a fool many times over since then, so I'd have a different view of being a fool, and I suspect it's reflected in my version.
You know, I just have to tell you, before we hear the first version of it, that I love the way you space in your phrasing, I'm a fool to want you. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I think of lyrics as a way of portraying what we are feeling inside and the way we speak normally and the peculiar things that go on in your head. And the words just sort of punctuate those feelings.
Okay, let's go back a little over 30 years and listen to your first recording of that.
Okay.
With Gil Evans' arrangements. And this is Helen Merrill singing I'm a Fool to Want You.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool. A love that's there for others too. I'm a fool.
What do you think about hearing that back now?
I think I did pretty well 30 years ago with the phrasing, and the music was certainly different. The key makes it sound quite different. The new record is a lot darker.
Yes, it is. That's right.
Yes, and Gil's conducting of the orchestra was entirely different. I think he was feeling differently, too, about music when we did the second record.
Would you explain what you mean by that?
Well, he was kind of feeling, I think, a little sadder than he did when we did the record 30 years ago. We had many conversations. He was very insulted by old age, and he was very frustrated by the inability of his body to respond to his brain. The problems with his eyes, and he just was insulted by old age, and his head was certainly not there. And so I think that was reflected in the way he performed the music.
The one new song that you recorded for the new record.
Ah, I like that one.
It's called Summertime.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called Summertime. Well, we all know Summertime. Why did you choose Summertime as the one extra song?
Because I like it.
Uh-huh. It's a very striking interpretation.
Thank you. That's a wonderful jazz vehicle. And I knew that it would be something that I would enjoy doing with Gil. As simple as that.
I think it's a hard song to make fresh since so many people have sung it already.
That's the beauty of jazz, though. You know, I think you can make everything fresh. I mean, there are so many ways to look at the emotions of those lyrics. I have sung it very angrily. I've sung it hopelessly and helplessly. I've sung it through the mind of the Universal Mother. You know, it's not at all a boring emotion. It's a very, very deep one that's going to exist forever. So it can't be boring. And as far as the music is concerned, that certainly is not so. No, I don't think that you can do that song enough too many times.
Summertime. It's easy. Fish are jumping. The cotton is high.
Your mother was a Seventh-day Adventist, right?
That's right.
When you started singing in clubs, did she oppose that?
My mother was not around to see that, but I can assure you she would have more than opposed it, yes.
She would have tried to prevent it.
Oh, no doubt about that, yeah.
So did you feel at all guilty about that?
I compensated.
How so?
Well, I was very shy, and I remained to myself pretty much, and I didn't put on too much perfume or lipstick on stage. Didn't go to too many dances until...
Didn't wear low-cut gowns?
No, definitely not. In fact, I used to forget to change my shoes sometime to go on stage, and one time Dinah Washington caught me. She said, Helen, come back here. I have to talk to you. And you can't go on stage with shoes like that.
What were you wearing?
My Oxfords with an evening gown on. So, no, I wasn't too into what one was supposed to be into you know, trying to be a star. But it was a lot to do with being Seventh-day Adventist. Yeah, really did.
You spent most of the 60s and 70s abroad, first living in Italy and then living in Japan. Why did you leave the United States?
Well, at that time, the only work available to me, and again, perhaps this is where the religion sort of came into it, but the only work available was a rotten, lousy, dirty jazz clubs. And places I wouldn't go to visit if I, you know, I just wouldn't even step inside them. And it was degrading to work in places like that. And furthermore, there was no money. Mostly people would drink and make a lot of noise. And it was just not dignified. A lot of us left the country at that time. And I found, to my surprise, that I did a lot of television shows. I did things that I certainly didn't do at home.
When you came back to the United States sometime in the 70s, was it hard for you to re-enter the jazz scene which you were so anxious to leave before?
It wasn't the jazz scene that I was leaving, and I wouldn't want to re-enter that scene that I left. I still don't want that scene. That hasn't changed. It is, re-enter the world of music, the business of music, like recording and so on. Yes, it was difficult. Sure, it was very, very hard.
Do you have places to perform?
I'm always working. I work, I'm leaving for Japan on Sunday, and I'm doing 14 concerts. I have 2 hit records in Paris. I do concerts there all the time. I'm going to do, after that, a radio show in Sweden. I'm quite busy.
I think your new record is going to get you a lot more attention in the United States now.
That'd be very nice. You mean, oh, I hope so. I hope you're right. Then I can do those nice college dates and things in this country. That'd be very nice. I'd like it. Seriously.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, then.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Singer Helen Merrill. Her new album with the late Gil Evans is called Collaboration. It's on Polygram Records, which has also reissued a box set of the albums she recorded for Mercury Records in the 1950s. The reissue is titled The Complete Helen Merrill. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's up in Panama?
Well, today General Noriega is expected to speak and possibly give his version of events as to why his negotiations with Washington, if indeed he acknowledges them, have not resulted in his leaving. Yesterday, remember, Secretary of State Schultz said that negotiations are off, and he described a deal which the U.S. had offered, which did not involve dropping criminal charges, but did call for Noriega to leave. Today, Noriega speaks. We've heard from some of the political opposition there. They say that junior pro-Noriega officers in the military scotched that deal yesterday, but we don't know what the man himself says.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Guest film critic Michael Schrago has a review of Willow, a new film from the people who brought us Star Wars. But Michael says this time the movie lacks original vision.
J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, once described the entire history of fantasy fiction and mythology as a soup. When you stick a ladle into it, you're apt to come up with ingredients that have appeared in stories from ancient times to the present. At his peak, George Lucas has dipped into that soup and emerged with Brave New Worlds of Fable. But in Willow, what he comes up with is as tasteless as bouillon and as stale as Deo'd Kool-Aid. Lucas is famous for turning his back on Hollywood and settling in Northern California. But his vision appears to have gotten stuck somewhere in the vicinity of Hollywood's La Brea tar pits. Willow mostly calls to mind dozens of other better movies, ranging from Lucas's own Star Wars to The Ten Commandments and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It's a malformed Tolkien-type fantasy, a victim of cinematic inbreeding, an elemental tale of good versus evil, set in an unnamed time of dread. Willow has state-of-the-art special effects, but it's all dressed up with nowhere to go. The movie is based on a story by Lucas, who's also the executive producer, but it aims no higher than the Saturday morning cartoon market. Director Ron Howard appears to have approached his job as if he were staging a pep rally at a kindergarten. Willow features at least three types of kiddie fantasy surrogates. There's the infant heroine, Alora Dannon, who's destined to save the world. Then there's the race of dwarfs known as Nelwyns. One of them, Willow, becomes Alora's guardian. And there are Willow's even tinier brownie friends. Here, the brownie's fairy queen explains the movie's plot to Willow and his pals.
Alora Dannon must survive. She must fulfill her destiny and bring about the downfall of Queen Batmorda, whose powers are growing like an evil plague. Unless she is stopped, Batmorda will control the lives of your village, your children, everyone. All creatures of good heart need your help, Willow. The choice is yours.
Yes, Lucas has made another coming-of-age parable. But most of the characters are cast in a mold that makes the whole concept of maturity pointless. Willow may have a wife and two kids, but he's still just Luke Skywalker built closer to the ground. By the end, Willow too must learn that the Force is with him. Except in this movie it's called The Great Mystery of the Universe, and it's harnessed through sorcery. Willow offers the by-now typical Lucasfilm quest. An innocent hero destroys an evil empire with an unlikely group of warriors. They include a dashing swordsman named Mad Mardigan, and the gutsy princess Sorsha. And the brownies are like R2-D2 and C-3PO, without the charm. The action is more like that of the James Bond films or the Indiana Jones movies. You can tell that just from the music and the sound effects. In one of the movie's few playful touches, the Evil Queen's hulking general is named after one of America's leading film critics. But this feebly executed joke backfires. 10 years from now, if anyone remembers Willow, it'll be because it had a character named after Pauline Kael.
Michael Schrago is movie critic for the San Francisco Examiner. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Dominic Dunn. In his Vanity Fair profiles and his best-selling novels, he writes about the clash between the old rich and the new rich. He says that rich and poor alike take pleasure in watching the rich stumble. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone will profile comic Will Durst, whose cutting political humor has been a little too cutting for David Letterman. And singer Susanna McCorkle will conclude her tribute to songwriter Irving Berlin. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.